Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. Before we get rolling, or should I say rockin' and rolling, a birthday greetings going out to Coast listener Justin Christo. A happy 50th birthday, wherever you are. That's from your sister, Margot. Happy birthday, Justin. Coming up in hour one, in addition to founding Twisted Sister, the world-famous heavy metal band that has sold more than 20 million records worldwide, J.J. French is one of the top entrepreneurs in entertainment. After taking over as manager in the 1970s, French developed Twisted Sister into the most heavily licensed heavy metal band in history, leading the group to perform more than 9,000 shows in 40 countries. Part business book, part memoir, Twisted Business is his unexpected, inspiring, whirlwind story of transformation and redemption. Twisted Business follows French's adventure-filled life from growing up in New York City in the 60s to working as a drug dealer and struggling as an addict before quitting cold turkey and finally to creating and cultivating Twisted Sister and turning it into one of the most successful brands in the world. In the book, French is brutally honest and he admits he became who he is because of his experiences and the reason why Twisted Sister was run like a business. And the reason the band were so straight was because he had a drug problem, and he was a drug dealer, a pretty successful one. And it was all those near disasters that scared him straight and then turned him into this brutally straight business guy. Coming up in hours two and three, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is an hallucinogenic tryptamine drug that occurs naturally in many plants and animals. It's also referred to as the spirit molecule. Due to the intense psychedelic experience, DMT has been used as a drug for thousands of years as part of shamanic ritual in South America. There's some evidence that DMT is also produced it's also produced in the pineal gland in the brain. Encounters with apparently sentient beings are reported by half of all first-time users of the naturally occurring psychedelic DMT. Yet, the question of DMT beings and plant sentience, interspecies communication, discarnate consciousness, and perhaps even dialoguing with the divine has never been systematically explored. Psychology lecturer Dr. David Luke will be here to talk about apparently sentient beings reported by many users of the psychedelic substance. He'll also delve into the shamanic perspective of invisible entities and the science behind hallucinations. Dr. Luke, along with Rory Spowers, have edited a new book titled DMT Entity Encounters, Dialogues on the Spirit Molecule. And coming up in hour four, open lines to round out a Saturday night, Sunday morning on Coast. All right, guess what? I've got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell. J.J. French, founding member of Twisted Sister, entrepreneur, motivational speaker, and genuine rock star, is next. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? J.J. French is not only a rock star, but a master of reinvention who knows the music business inside and out. As a guitarist for Twisted Sister, playing 9,000 shows in 34 countries and selling more than 20 million albums, J.J. has also become a disciplined businessman, band manager, director of merchandising, publishing, and touring. J.J. developed Twisted Sister into a global brand with multiple revenue streams and built it into the most licensed heavy metal band in history. J.J. is only a handful of people in the world of rock and roll who have succeeded both on the artistic side, being a part of a world-class band, while simultaneously managing all aspects of their business and operations. This highly unique ability provides JJ with insights that are virtually unmatched. On his new podcast, The JJ French Connection, he shares stories from five decades in the business and takes listeners on a rock star tour through the music business and beyond. And his brand new book, half memoir, half business book, which he has dubbed a bizmoir and written with Steve Forbes, is called Twisted Business: Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll. JJ French, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Richard, it is a pleasure to be on the show. I am a big fan of yours on your conspiracy show, and I've been a fan of Coast to Coast going back to the Art Bell days, and I am really excited to be here, so thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, and likewise excited. I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time. I neglected to mention among your countless accomplishments, New York City's all-time Boy Scout cookie salesman.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
And it's right, that's how you bought your first axe, right?
Yeah. First, I don't want to just say that I'm so excited to be talking to you. I'm in Los Angeles tonight. Tomorrow, I'm making a personal appearance at the Grove, the Barnes & Noble, to sign the book. So if you're in the area, please stop by and come by and say hi. My co-writer, Steve Farber, will be with me at the signing, and we look forward to seeing you. So as it started with the Boy Scouts, yes, I was a Boy Scout, and most people don't know that Boy Scouts sold cookies. Everyone knows Girl Scouts sold cookies, but not Boy Scouts. And my troop, when I was 13 years old, brought the cookies in, and I sold 110 boxes that year, and I kind of had the record for it. Then they threw me out the following year for having long hair. And remember, this is 1965, 66, in that period, and I wanted to buy a guitar, and my father thought that $25 was way too much to spend on this hobby. So he wouldn't give me the 25 bucks, and I got a call from the Boy Scout master about 6 months after they threw me out. And he said, listen, you know, you did such a good job selling cookies last year. You think you could sell cookies this year? Which is kind of really gutsy of the guy, considering that he threw me out for having long hair. And my father, astutely, he was a jewelry salesman, you know, and a New York guy, you know, a hustling guy as we are in New York, said, put the phone down. Let me tell you something. And I said, what? He says, tell the guy that you want to get 10 cents a box commission for selling the cookies. And if he's that desperate, he'll give it to you. And then we'll go out and we're going to sell enough cookies for you to buy that guitar. And I said that to the Boy Scout master, and he agreed. So then he gave me all these cookies. We went down to 47th Street. It was the jewelry district in New York, and I sold 242 boxes and made $24.20. And my dad, being the big spender, threw in the 80 cents. And with that $25, I bought my first guitar. And then I went from there to fireworks, to firecrackers, and then when I turned 15, bingo, I started selling pot. And, you know, I was telling people back then, it's going to be a hot commodity. And, Richard, I was right. Everyone's selling weed. It's legal.
Right. Your dad, you mentioned, he wanted you to go into the jewelry business. And your mom was very active in politics, a campaign for JFK. She wanted you to get into politics. But then you saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan and all that changed, right?
Yeah, you know, my father wanted me to be a jewelry salesman. I asked him, how do you make money? He says, well, the big money's in diamonds, but it's dangerous. You can get killed. And no sooner did he say that to me than, I was involved in an armed robbery of a diamond dealer in my building in Manhattan just because I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I wound up in the middle of an armed robbery in the lobby, and the people who were robbing this guy of diamonds put a gun to my head and threatened to kill me. And I was so freaked out, I screamed, and they ran. Luckily, they didn't pull the trigger, and they got away with $100,000 worth of diamonds. And I thought to myself, that is not a particularly safe profession to be in. And my mother wanted me to get into politics and had a lot of connections. She worked for the JFK campaign, the Bobby Kennedy campaign, just about every major politician in the New York area in the 60s. When Kennedy was assassinated, however, I deduced that that wasn't exactly the safest business to be in either. And then, lo and behold, the Beatles come on television, and I went, wow, that seems to check all the boxes. It's rock and roll, it's girls, it's screaming, it's billions of dollars, I guess, you know, whatever that meant. You know, I thought, oh, my God, I want to do that. Now, that was, as people know, on February 9th, 1964. I looked at the television set. I said, that's what I want to do. Now, at that moment, Richard, had somebody put their hand on my shoulder and said, okay, Mr. French, you will have a gold record, but it's going to be 20 years and 6 months from now. I think I probably would have rethought the decision to.
Right. Gone back to selling cookies and firecrackers, maybe. And how did you become such a rebel and revolutionary in high school? You started a riot in your high school, if I remember correctly from the book.
Yeah, you know, it was the times. You know, remember, these are the 60s. It was turbulent. Anti-war demonstrations, civil rights marches. If you grew up in the 60s in New York, I know the cliche, if you grew up in the 60s and you remember it, you weren't really there. But I'll refute that. I was there, and I remember distinctly many things about it. It was a fabulous time to be involved in all of these events. I was involved by selling drugs. I was involved in playing rock and roll. I was involved in anti-war activities. So you could say I was multitasking at an early age. What happened was I got caught up in the political sturm und drang of the period. You remember, in those days, Richard, you could go to the Fillmore East and see every major rock star you would ever imagine for $3. And people find this hard to fathom and understand, because it's almost like saying, you know, you're talking to your dad, he goes, when I was a boy, gas was $10, 10 cents a gallon. But in truth, you could see Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead and Janis Joplin and Jeff Beck, and you know, and they all played in New York for $3 or $4, and if you couldn't afford it, you saw them at the Central Park at the Schaefer Festival for $1. So you can have rock and roll on your life every week, on and on and on. And while this was going on, the anti-war movement was going on, and I got involved in a situation where I went to hear H. Rapp Brown speak at Columbia University, and it so inflamed my left-wing mentality that I went back to my high school and kind of started a riot, and the riot eventually emptied out the school, and I was held responsible for starting this thing, and they threw me out. They let me back in if I agreed not to be disruptive. That lasted about 6 months, because I handed out an underground newspaper 6 months later. They said that I was being disruptive by handing out an underground newspaper, which was politically charged. They threw me out again, and I sued the Board of Education for violating my constitutional rights as freedom of the press. They settled that case, put me in another high school. By the time I got to that high school, I had been featured in national magazines as a high school revolutionary of the year. And with that, with the reputation, I just wanted to graduate. But instead, the second high school was involved in very heavily politically, again, having to do with the feeling that black and Hispanic students were being tracked into vocational colleges. And they demanded a parent representative with the guidance counselor so that these kids would be fairly tracked into academic schools as well if they wanted to. And that led to more riots and more demonstrations. And eventually, in early May of 1970, with 2 months to go in my high school career, I decided to leave New York. I fell in love with a girl who happened to be the great-granddaughter of Robert E. Lee. I know the story gets stranger. We get into it in the book in depth. I go down to Richmond, Virginia, seriously, on the street where they just took the Robert E. Lee statue off, because you know that just happened last right. week, as a matter of fact. And the Kent State kids were killed that week. And that, of course, set off a chain of events of riots all over the United States. And it inflamed the youth culture of the United States in ways that people find hard to believe unless you live through it. And I came back from Richmond and proclaimed to my mother that I'm dropping out of school. And she said, you're an idiot. You've got 2 months to go. And I said, no, I don't. I have not been in class all year long. I've been getting high every day, dealing every day. I have not been in class. And besides which, don't worry about me. this is what I said to my mom. I said, don't worry about me. I'm going to be a rock star. It sounded good. I just wanted to stop the conversation.
Right, right. Now, I'm racing ahead here because there's so much in the book and what a life you have lived. But after a couple of close calls with overdosing, one with, and they're in kind of disturbing detail in the book, one with heroin, one with acid and so forth, you decided that's it. It's time to get serious about the music business. And you were in and out of a couple of bands. You had what you kind of describe as a close call. You almost became a member of Wicked Lester, a band that would go on to become known as Kiss. And looking, I guess at the time, you got beat out by Ace Frehley, and you were kind of thankful after sort of witnessing an incident. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, you know, to be really clear about this, and I put it historically in perspective, I'm sure they auditioned many guitar players during that period of time. I happen to have a brush of the opportunity to audition for them as Wicked Lester, and they didn't pick me, and that was fine. You know, their vision was correct. I mean, they had a spectacular vision for what they wanted to do, but several months after I was turned down by the band, they eventually did hire Ace Frehley, and I did go to the Loft, and I did watch them play for their producer, Ron Johnson, probably the very first time ever that they played Kissified, all the Wicked Lester songs, and they were fantastic, and Ace was really the right guy at the time. He was a wonderful player, and he was spectacular for the band. But he also, Ace voiced an opinion to the producer that he thought the band was ready to go out and play publicly, and Gene pulled him aside and stuck his finger in his face and said, don't you ever give your opinion again. Only I will be the only one to decide. And I thought to myself, well, we wouldn't have gotten along too well if he had done that to me. So, you know, Ace wound up where he needed to be, and of course, Kiss went on to an astonishing career. And 3 months later, Twisted Sister was founded.
How many iterations of Twisted Sister? Because it formed around 1973, I think. And how many iterations before the classic lineup, yourself and Dee Snider and Mark Mendoza and Eddie and the late AJ Perreault? How many iterations were there?
There are about 11 different versions that kept permutating. You know, 73 was an interesting year, Richard, because Judas Priest was founded in 73, Kiss was founded in 73, AC/DC was founded in 73, and we were founded in 73. And I think if you asked any of us in 73 how long our careers would last, we would all have said 5 years. That was like the automatic response in those days. There was no way to predict it. Certainly when Twisted started, I was the last original member to be brought into this band that was called Silver Star for a very brief period of time, like 2 months. And then it changed its name to Twisted Sister. And then the book really details this climb of constantly changing, constantly evolving, going through band member and lineup changes, and the reasons why the lineup changes occurred and the reinvention that had to take place to get us from point A to point B. So as you know, Richard, the band exploded into the world stage in 1984. We had already been together 11 years in various incarnations. And the stories that got us to where we got to the MTV era is really what makes the entire book, the body of the book, as you know.
Right, and I'm enjoying the book. I'm in part two now, and there's a chapter in there called Tenacity. You take each letter in the word Twisted, and that becomes sort of the theme of that chapter. T in Twisted is for tenacity, W for wisdom, I for inspiration. I'm on inspiration right now, but we'll take a time out. When we come back, I want to talk about tenacity that you had. It's what a roller coaster ride. Just before you were finally signed by Atlantic Records around 83, there were so many ups and downs and close calls and near misses. And, 99.9% of people would have given up, but you didn't. And we'll get into that in just a few moments here. J.J. French is with us, and we'll also talk about the brand new podcast, The J.J. French Connection, which is a great name. And the new book, Twisted Business, Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll, written along with Steve Farber. More of my conversation with JJ on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. The Price, a fan favorite for Twisted Sister fans, the group's most popular ballad, I'm told, was inspired when Dee Snider answered a phone call at the studio from JJ's sister-in-law, who asked how he was doing, and Dee hadn't seen his wife and son for a few months, and he said he was feeling pretty blue. She responded, "Well, I guess that's the price you have to pay." On October 9th, the work will be performed, on October 9th, Ludwig von Beethoven, who died in 1827, was just 3 years removed from the completion of his Ninth Symphony, a work heralded by many of his as his magnum opus. He started work on his Tenth Symphony, but due to deteriorating health, he wasn't able to make much headway. All he left behind were some musical sketches. Ever since, Beethoven fans and musicologists have puzzled and lamented over what could have been. His notes teased at some magnificent reward, albeit one that seemed forever out of reach. Now, thanks to the work of a team of music historians, musicologists, composers, and computer scientists, Beethoven's vision will come to life. On October 9th, the work will be performed in Bonn, Germany, and a recording will be released. The use of artificial intelligence and a leading group of scientists at the creative AI startup Playform AI taught a machine both Beethoven's entire body of work and his creative process. Again, a full recording of Beethoven's 10th Symphony is set to be released on October the 9th, the same day as the world premiere performance scheduled to take place in Bonn, Germany, the culmination of a two-year-plus effort. You can read more of that story in the news, how artificial intelligence completed Beethoven's unfinished 10th Symphony, in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with J.J. French, the author of Twisted Business, right here on Coast to Coast AM. J.J. French stays with us, founding member of Twisted Sister, and his new bizmoir is called Twisted Business, Lessons for My Life in Rock and Roll. I was mentioning before the break, J.J., this roller coaster, it seemed like you, your band, were on the cusp of making it. One night, famed record producer Eddie Kramer comes to see you, but it didn't quite work out the way you'd hoped. What happened?
Well, first of all, he came to a night that was 1979. That was affected by the gasoline shortage of 1979. So normally we play into full houses, but we kind of realized that it wasn't going to happen that summer because of the gas shortage. This was the second gas shortage that we had played through over the 10 years prior to the record deal. But a girl came up to me during soundcheck and said this producer named Eddie Kramer is going to come down. Now, Eddie Kramer is one of the most famous producers in the world, and I asked her, why would she even know who he is? And she said, well, he keeps his money in a bank that her mother is a teller in, and she said she was talking to him, and he says, yeah, tonight I'm going to go see a band called Twisted Sister. And the mother told the daughter, and the daughter came running to me, so everybody was kind of skeptical. But yes, he did show up. It was raining. There was maybe 50 people in the club. The band did its normal crazy show. He was very, very impressed. We did a production deal with Eddie Kramer. We recorded several songs with him. This was, unfortunately, one of the many aborted attempts of trying to get a record deal because nothing happened with those tapes. And that just kind of exemplified the history. You know, the band is in a world, Richard, of reinvention. And you know the entertainment industry is all about reinvention. It's the toughest business in the world because it is a what have you done for me lately. You can't even enjoy the success that you have when you have it because invariably you can have a big hit record. And the first question they say to you is, so what's your next project? And you go, excuse me, can I just enjoy this for 5 minutes? And what the book really does, it really takes you through systematically the twisted method of reinvention. And it uses the word twisted because it's easy to remember it as the anagram. So you have T-W-I-S-T-E-D, it's tenacity, wisdom, inspiration, stability, trust, excellence, and discipline. So what the book really does is it is a business guidebook to tell you and to take your company, your life, through these various stages. Because, as you know, we were turned down more times than a bedsheet, and we've come back more times than Freddy Krueger and Michael Myers. And the story of how we continued to come back with all of the adversity over and over and over again is really the untold story of the band and the crux of what the book is all about. And because I do motivational speaking and business conferences, it really allows a structure to explain to people how important reinvention truly is.
Right. You mentioned the demo tapes that you cut. I believe those were at Electric Lady Studios. And I guess you didn't know at the time Eddie Kramer had kind of cut this side deal with the studio that if you ever sold a record, you'd have to pay them an extra, $25,000? And share a little bit of the details. It's a great story.
There was a side arrangement made that if the tapes were used and we got a record deal, that we would go back to the studio. Now, that's not an unusual arrangement, incidentally. When you do demos back in the day with major studios and you didn't have much money, they would say, okay, fine, give us this little money, but if you really get a deal with this stuff, we expect you to make the record here. That's really what they expect you to do. Or if you're not going to go here, pay us a certain amount of money, a much larger amount than what you initially paid. And that only goes to producers, record studios, but also goes to producers. So we weren't really aware that this penalty was happening. And when these demos surfaced as independent records that we kind of printed just to give to our fans something, you know, we said, hey, we have a record. It's really on Twisted Sister Records. You know, we just printed these 45 singles at the time. We didn't think anybody would ever interpret that as a record deal. But in fact, the studio owner interpreted it as a record deal and called me into the studio and basically said, you owe me about $25,000 or I'm going to break your kneecaps. And while we played in the bar scene and the bar circuit in those days, and you could imagine the kind of people that you meet when you are in that world, no one had ever threatened me before. And this person actually threatened to physically harm me had we not paid him this money. And so let's just say arrangements were made copacetically to come to an agreement, which we go into depth in the book. To give you another example of what happens during the course of a band's lifespan, as the band is trying to make it and going through change after change after change after change after change. You know, Dee was the fourth lead singer. The first lead singer named the band. He pulled a gun out on the drummer in a drunken bar fight. He got thrown out. The second lead singer, he lasted 9 weeks, although in his mind he lasted a year. It shows you how stoned he was. He only lasted 9 weeks, and he just disappeared. I took over then, but my voice is terrible. You know, God created Bob Dylan so I could do cover material. And my agent at the time said, you need to do Led Zeppelin songs if you're going to make any money. And Danny Snyder, Dee, could sing Zeppelin perfectly, and also he shared my hatred of drugs and alcohol. This is the key thing. I sat with him. I said, you know, I really have had it with drugs and alcohol. I can't stand it. It just destroys the ability for a band to continue. And he goes, I hate drugs and alcohol. I want you're my guy. You know, you're my guy. And then Mark Mendoza, the bass player, he joined. You know, I said, you know, we're not into getting high. He goes, I hate drugs and alcohol. I said, you're my guy. The only problem, Richard, about being a straight band in this world that we're in is that the record label doesn't want people to know that you're straight because it would destroy your following. Now, think about this reverse logic for a second, Richard. If you're a politician and you're found in a hotel room with an underage girl and cocaine, you're done. You know, you're done. And if you're a sports star and you're found in a hotel room with somebody underage and cocaine, you're done. But in the world of rock and roll, if you're found in a hotel with an underage girl and cocaine, they write songs about you and give you a Grammy. And you become like a legend. Yeah. So we live in this world of stunted emotional development, and I had really no desire to be a part of that world. I didn't want that world, and we constructed a band that was straight and just worked really, really hard, but we were cautioned by our label and our agents, booking agents, to never tell people that you are because it would hurt your reputation.
before you finally signed that deal, there was, you were so close a number of times. One time it looked like it was a done deal, and I think the studio head had a heart attack. Another studio, the record label went bankrupt.
We had a deal on the table with this producer, this German producer, and this was probably the fourth deal because we had already been almost signed on a number of occasions. And then this other time we came so close, and the producer, you know, came to New York and met with the band and took our demo tapes and flew to LA for a meeting and came back to New York, and we exchanged contracts, and it looked like we were just about finally had a deal after, you know, years and years and years of struggling. And my lawyer called me and he said the guy had a heart attack on the plane back to Germany. You know, and he said, he's sitting down. I said, yeah, why? He said, the guy had a heart attack. He said, he's dead? Well, he may not be, but the deal is. And that deal fell apart. So then when we finally got signed to a label called Secret in 1982, so secret that nobody ever heard of it, but that record company president, when he heard our music and contacted us in New York and said, yes, for sure, this is great, man. This is perfect. I have a punk label. I think you're a punk band, and I want to sign you. He even told us the date and time that he was coming to see us. And we thought, well, this is how the conversation went. If he does fly over to the United States to see us, the plane will probably blow up over the Atlantic. But if the plane lands and he gets in the car to drive to Poughkeepsie, he will die in a car crash on the way to the gig. However, if he gets to the gig, the PA system will fall on top of the band and kill the band. So he does land. He does get in the car. He does get there, and he sees a great show, and he walks in the dressing room, and he says, you know, you're great, and I'm going to sign you. And the band has no response. And he walks out, and he tells somebody in my crew, I don't understand. I just saw the band. I'm going to sign them. They haven't reacted. And the guy says, well, you have to understand what they're thinking, and this is what we were thinking. D goes, $10 says he dies in a car crash on the way back to the airport. Mendoza goes, $500 says that he dies in a plane crash on the way back to England. Well, what happens is he goes back to England, and then there's a snowstorm, which is the worst snowstorm in 100 years, and it wipes out his office, which is so typical. And we thought for sure the deal was going to be dead, but the deal did eventually go through, and we were offered the deal, and we signed the deal in early April of 1982. There was only one problem. The day we signed the deal with this English record label, England went to war in the Falkland Islands that day. And I thought, well, there'll be no natural material to make the record because they're going to use it to fight this war in England. However, we do go to England. We do record the record. It is called Under the Blade, and it was our debut album. And we actually took a photo on the back cover on the my 30th birthday. I promised myself when I was 29, if I didn't have a deal by the time I was 30, I couldn't take the rejection any longer. We took the photo. The album comes out Labor Day weekend. However, the record label went bankrupt 2 weeks later.
Wow. And then finally, just to get to the end here, Atlantic finally signs you. And then you find out that the head over at Atlantic, he hates the band.
Yeah, the president of Atlantic Records had made a statement to his executive group in early December of 1982. And what he said was, if anybody mentions the name Twisted Sister as a possible signing, they will be fired. He made this proclamation to this young executive named Jason Flom, as a matter of fact, who was 19 at the time, and he was an A&R guy, and he had signed a band called Zebra, and he really wanted to sign Twisted Sister, and he told this to Doug, and Doug says, they're terrible, they've been turned down by everybody in New York, they can't be any good, they have to be terrible, there's no way I'm going to sign them. And he called me and said, I'm sorry, I really tried my best, but, you know, I was just told if I even mention the name again, I will be fired. And what we did was we borrowed $22,000 from various people, flew to England, and did this Hail Mary pass of a television show, which you can watch on YouTube. Just put in Twisted Sister, The Tube, T-U-B-E. You will see the band in desperation mode. This was the Hail Mary show. This was it. If we didn't get a deal from this, it was over. And basically, D just went crazy on live television in England, took his makeup off on the air. Members of Motorhead came on stage, and we blew the studio apart. And the next day, every record label wanted to sign us, and the English head of Atlantic said, I just need to call the guy in New York and let him know. Of course, we said to ourselves, well, then that's not going to happen because he hates us. And what happened was he did call that guy, and that guy could not believe that he heard our name again. Oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. They suck. I don't want. And the guy says, listen, man, I'm telling you, I'm going to sign them. He says, you sign them. You keep them there. I don't even want them in America. And so we signed with Atlantic, made an album called Can't Stop Rock and Roll, which became a huge hit in England, had a top 10 single called I Am, I'm Me. And with all of that amazing hype, we come to back to America as victors, only to find out that the record label could care less and told us that we went over budget by $4,500. And if we didn't pay them the $4,500, they weren't going to release the record.
Wow. Wow. $4,500. That's a four martini lunch for them.
You know, Richard, it's insane when you think Def Leppard and Fleetwood Mac, you know, they spend millions making a record. And yet we went over budget by $4,500. And they said to us, if you don't figure out a way to pay us back, we are not even going to release that album here. And these are the kind of stories that are in the book.
Right. And you went on tour on your own dime. They weren't going to pay for promotion. You got such a tremendous response. Word got back to this president at Atlantic, and he basically changed his mind, right?
Yeah. A year later, just about a year to the day of the proclamation of I Hate This Band, we had toured on our own dime. We had crisscrossed the country in a number of times with Winnebagos and rent-a-cars, with no tour support whatsoever, backing up all kinds of bands, playing 29-minute sets under threat of having our powers taken away from us by the headlining act if we went past 29 minutes, driving from one end of the country to the other, then flying back over to Europe and getting in the van and doing a whole set of shows in Europe and then coming back to the United States. And after a whole year of this insane quest to be successful, that same record company president was up at his offices when I was there doing an interview, and I was brought into his office and introduced to him. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he said, you know what I think about your band? And I said, yeah, actually, I do. I do know what you think about our band. And he said, well, let me read you something. And you know, Richard, in those days, there was no, there were no fax machines. There was telexes in those days. It was in 1983. And he pulls out all these telexes. And he's reading us these telexes. Twisted played in Miami. How come we got no support from the label? This is from a label representative. Twisted played in St. Louis. They were amazing. How come we got no support? Twisted played in L.A. How come we got no support? And then we played in Canada, in Montreal and Toronto, your home territory, Richard.
Right.
And the head of WEA, Warner Music in Canada, Régis Desjardins, sent this telex going, I don't understand you. This band came up here, Toronto and Montreal, blew the place apart, and yet no support from the home label. And the guy looked at me and he said, I made a mistake. You give me the right record, and next year I'll make you one of the biggest bands in the world. Now, you would think, Richard, that I would have been jumping up and down, but I didn't believe him. And he looked at me and he said, listen, do you know who owns MTV? And I said, no. He says, we do. I said, what do you mean we do? He said, Warner Music and American Express at that time owned MTV. Most people didn't know that. And he said, if you give me the right video, I will make you one of the biggest bands in the world. And in fact, obviously, we did. We're not going to take it. And he made us one of the biggest bands in the world. And if that didn't happen, you and I wouldn't be on this phone call.
20 million albums later, 9,000 shows, nearly 40 countries. What a story. And it's all in Twisted Business, Lessons from My Life in Rock and Roll. JJ, what a great pleasure. We'll have to have you back on. There's so much more here.
Thank you so much, Richard. And by the way, thanks for promoting my podcast. Again, tomorrow I will be at the Grove at Barnes & Noble at 2 p.m. If you're in L.A., please come by so I can sign the book and meet you. Richard, it's always a pleasure being on your show. A great supporter. And thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. All the best. All right. We'll talk DMT with Dr. David Luke on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.